offering a loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Hari Shankar from the Shri Satya Sai Central Trust. This is a program where we go through Swami's discourses. The 1991 Samarkosh series is what we're going through, and right now we are in the middle of the sixth discourse in that series, and this entire series is about the Upanishads, and this particular discourse is about the Prashnopanishad. So before we kind of summarize whatever we've gone through in this discourse so far and see further what Swami has to say, I invite Brother Hari to join all of us. Sanam Hari.
Sanam Prem.
I think we'll start with a short summary, and there's some very interesting points that Swami made in that discourse so far, and many of those points were made in the passing. Like Swami does not elaborate into that. It's almost like given to us to think over, and I think in the course of the discourse through the Prashnopanishad, Swami kind of reveals some of that. Of course, the first thing is Swami starts with Paropakarartham, and there's something which Swami says about, you know, the selfishness and self-interest. He says that is literally the cause for the state in which our country is or our society is, in whatever deplorable state it is. Swami says the cause is selfishness and selflessness. But then he goes on to say that it's not that they're completely bad, but a certain amount of limit is required for it. But then he says a selfish person cannot sustain human qualities. It's a very interesting point that Swami is making, because if we look at evolution from the other species, invariably we've been taught that the force which kind of takes them from one level to the other, or even leading a species to become a better and more robust species as such, is this desire to sustain itself, to survive, live, to endure, to survive. Right? So there is a certain amount of selfishness in that.
There is, yes.
Self-interest. So when we see that in general evolution, we see that self-interest is what is leading to the progression. Swami is saying here, selflessness will lead you to maintain your humanness. So I don't know, what are your thoughts on it? How do you put these two together?
Yeah, so I recall actually there is this the book written by Dr. Samuel Sandweiss.
Right.
So it's called The Spirit and the Mind.
Okay.
I remember reading this very long back, and he brings up precisely this point. So even in psychology, they do accept that you need the ego. So ego drives us towards like competition.
Okay.
And sometimes it is competition that spurs us on to bring out the best out of us. With many of us, you know, like we've got maybe so many hidden capabilities, talents, skills, but that gets expressed only when, you know, there is competition. It's not always, you know, inspiration or something that draws out the best. So he does mention that for the growth of an individual, right, even for an individual, to a certain extent this is required. So I think I recall the first time when I heard that segment of the discourse where Swami says that it is required to a certain extent. For a second, I was you know, off balance. Then I recalled, you know, that from the psychological point of view, it is very much required for the individual to grow to a certain extent, right? So that's how you become like who you are.
Right.
And that is part of the, you know, so after that, if you got to express in such a way your talents, your skills, right, in such a way that society then benefits, okay, in that case, that is where you got to now start, you know, not becoming a slave to that ego, right? Even when it comes to species, right, when you're talking about species and how a species compete in order to survive,
right?
But you know, one anomaly which many you know, those who study nature, one of the things they see is how, first of all, sometimes there are individuals in the species which will sacrifice themselves in order for the, you know, larger, for the society or the, you know, larger species community to progress. Another thing is that there is what is called as interspecies cooperation. Like we see that, say humans,
symbiotic relationship.
Right? Yeah, not just that. There is absolutely nothing for that particular individual, for that particular species. They don't gain anything. I mean, I'm talking about like again at an individual level, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these are things which are anomalous. They are not completely within the ambit, or they don't fit within the framework of survival,
mm-hmm.
right? And as you see Maslow's hierarchy, which we see in. So survival is like just one part of our human existence. And as you can see, like, present human life, for most of us, luckily, like, survival is like, you know, it's done.
Mm.
And so it's easy for us to progress on the, like, higher levels. And that is where, like, Swami invites us to find, like, more fulfillment at the higher levels than at the level of survival. That's how I see it.
I think I remember reading that very study. I think probably the same article where they talk about these relationships which we usually study in school. Of course, the parasitic is one where one species kind of completely lives on the other one, but the other ones where, you know, there is some kind of give and take
between two species.
They say you can't call that selflessness because
there
is a certain amount of self-interest with which the union happens. But again, they were talking about, I think there is one particular species of squirrels where invariably that squirrel which alerts the rest of the group that there's a predator coming kind of knows that it's going to become the prey. Because in the process of alerting, standing there and giving that signal, it loses precious few seconds and it becomes the victim for that day. So they say that there is this kind of selfishness, but I don't know, probably when you talk about human nature, I don't know whether any other species has this ability to choose that let me not take for myself,
exactly.
Let me give.
Yeah.
Probably it's there between the mother and the offspring, even in other species. But in a general way, the ability to say that, let me give up what I can have and let it go to somebody else.
That's right.
Probably that's what defines the human nature itself.
Yeah.
And Swami says, if it is not there, again, as you're saying, you're going to the base of the Maslow hierarchy, where you're giving more importance to self-interest and survival in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, just to summarize it, there is a role for, and up to a certain extent, right? And it satisfies or stabilizes us, and thereupon it's upon us, it's up to us, like how we find fulfillment, how we find meaning and purpose in.
And we were talking about ego being important, and you're saying, I think many times you've seen Swami using that to an extent, to bring out the best. When you're saying that we all have talents and we probably don't bring it out unless there is an environment of competitiveness.
Yes.
Many times Swami creates it.
Yeah.
It could even be guided by your devotion.
Precisely.
Right? It may not necessarily be to that one upmanship. It's not necessarily that attitude. But it could even be that to present the best in front of Swami.
Exactly.
That sort of thing. Just recently, we had gone for this workshop and we had heard Dr. Rajeshwari Patel. She was sharing a very beautiful incident of how they were planning to do a mass marriage during one of Swami's birthdays. And Swami was very happy with the idea. They'd done a lot of groundwork. They'd made a list of people who would be participating in the ceremony. They started off with 70 or 75, but they ended up with 225 odd couples. So Swami was very happy, completely involved in the entire thing. Swami is asking, what are you giving? Where have you purchased it from? Have you looked into the sizes? And all of that detail Swami was going through. And one particular weekend when they had come from Anantapur, they're all teachers from the Anantapur campus, most of them, Swami suddenly said, let's not have this. And Swami was very upset. He said, let's not have this at all. So they were very perplexed and said, what went wrong suddenly? And they said, Swami, so much of the preparation is done. We've made so much of the purchases and all that. Swami said, no, you all are not capable of doing it. Okay. He said, Swami, what went wrong? And then Swami said, see, there are many of these elders, they're saying that Swami, what will they perform? They are themselves not married.
Mm.
And, you know, there are a lot of legal complications that can arise.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people just come and participate in an event like this. They might be already married.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it brings a lot of confusion. Then you will be answerable to, you know, people. Swami said, see, all these elders are saying like this. So let's cancel it off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they didn't know what to do. They went back and they discussed. And so then they came up with this elaborate plan of making this whole thing foolproof, right? They completely typed out their names with a photograph. They went to the panchayat office, got certificates that these people are, you know, unmarried, then registered it in the MRO, saying that we are performing this marriage. These are the people who have given the affidavit saying that they're not married.
Right.
A whole lot of paperwork, a bunch of all their applications with this legal, you know, background being done. They sent that whole envelope to Swami. Okay, the moment Swami saw that, and the next time when they went, Swami was like absolutely happy after that. Swami said, hey, we'll go and we'll do it, don't worry. Then they were wondering what happened to the thing of Swami, we are all unmarried. And Swami said, so what, I am there, I will guide you as to what has to be done. So she was saying that, you know, when they stepped back, it was almost like Swami was pushing them to the point where they rose to the occasion and they brought their best. Where Swami was saying that, you know, someone is telling me and someone is... definitely somebody must have started the topic off.
Sure.
But they said that, you know, none of us had this kind of a background. We knew this. But in a sense, that's what Swami would... Many times when I would feel, you know, when you come to Swami, when you're Swami students, one thing which Swami would often repeat is, students are my property. That actually gives you a lot of, that belonging gives you a sense of responsibility. So when you talk of self-interest and a little bit of ego and within the limits, probably this is the sublimation of that you know, nature which is there in each one of us. And of course then Swami goes on to speak about, he again reiterates that point where even if we live as a human, it is enough in the current world. You know, where he says that, after saying that selflessness sustains your human nature. And then Swami goes on to this particular theme which this Upanishad stands for. The relationship between world as it is seen and God, the unseen divinity. And Swami speaks about how they are interrelated. And this
energy
is the main thing.
And matter.
Energy
too.
And matter. And Swami speaks of how, you know, the unity of matter and energy is what is established in this Upanishad. Then Swami speaks about how there is this misunderstanding from both sides, from the side of science and from the side of spirituality.
Right.
Where scientists think that spirituality has got to do only with philosophy. And the spiritualists believe that science has got to do only with material. And this is clearly seen, I think, if you go a little back in our into our history, there was no difference between a sage and a saint.
Right.
Most of our you know, inventions, or even if you talk about the number system and all that, they were all come up with people who in their day would have been seen as spiritual people. Right. And I think that's the same with even if you look at the Islamic world, during their golden period, in the, I think the Middle Ages, not Middle Ages,
800 to 600 to 800,
same was the thing. You know, they were all very, very spiritual people, but who came up with algebra and all of these studies.
Now, even if you look at like Gregor Mendel, there are some examples of scientists even in like Europe, where so they were. By the way, the Big Bang theory, like one of the models which is prevalent today, the inflationary model. So that was actually given by a priest, Lemaitre. I wouldn't know how to pronounce it exactly, but he was a priest who, it seems that he used to come to Einstein and really used to annoy him, saying that, you know, from your equations, this is the theory that I worked out. And he used to come in full, you know, the cassock of a priest, a very incongruous presence. But yeah, it, a lot of such discoveries or models have come from men of God.
I mean, as someone was pointing out, the guiding principle is the same. It's the same quest for the truth.
For the truth,
And a very, very strong sense of honesty.
Yes.
You know, I think that's
Yeah, that's a very astute observation. that both science and spirituality call for precisely the same things. That
right.
is, as you said, the uncompromising quest for truth and complete honesty. That's what it has to be, uncompromising.
Right. And then Swami goes on to speak about what this Upanishad is about.
Yeah.
Then comes to that story which we were midway in, the story of Pipalada, the sage to whom these six disciples come and ask him about what is the nature of man. And he gives this beautiful answer, and he, I mean, as we had discussed last time, that there is this paradox in which Swami says that, first of all, not many have that yearning. That yearning is very important.
Yes.
Swami says 1 in 100 crore or 1 in 1 crore have that yearning to find out the purpose of life. So have the yearning, foster the yearning, but have the patience. You know, stay unswerving from the thing, at the same time without becoming restless.
Because right.
You always associate patience with restlessness. I'm sorry, patience with a very calm nature, very
resignation.
Kind of a very easily, probably, having that, waiting for that thing to happen without a sense of restlessness.
Right.
But you associate yearning with a sort of restlessness. But, have the yearning, but also have the patience.
Right.
That's what the sage says. He says, stay in the ashram, work here for a year, observe all these principles. What are the three things he says in that?
So he asks them to observe, one is celibacy.
Celibacy, right.
Like brahmacharya. Then he asks them to observe truth. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you recall, what Swami said about brahmacharya, we were discussing
right.
Some important points came up. I recall Swami saying that brahmacharya is like, it has something to do with celibacy, but the most important thing is that the mind should be focused on Brahman.
Correct.
And that's what I think, interestingly enough, that as we noted, these six students who came to Sage Pipalada, they're all actually sons of sages.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them, to some extent, have grown up in that kind of atmosphere where they, they've contemplated on Brahman, and yet they come to, Sage Pipalada, and he tells them to wait for 1 year. Like, I think that is pretty significant. And through that 1 year, the kind of churning that they have to go through. So he says tapas. You have to go through penance. You have to go through austerities. So he tells them that, so the control, as Swami also points out, control of the senses is one of the most important prerequisites, right? In order, and I think this is what the Kenopanishad kind of built this, it built this foundation. And as we said, it has, we can tie it up to what in the Ashtanga Yoga we speak about Yama and Niyama.
Niyama, right?
So a lot of it has to do with, the silencing or the taming of the senses, so to speak. Somebody was observing, right? Nowadays, we, our work days are pretty hectic and all that. And then you want to actually take rest. You want to, wind down.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us, what we do end up doing is that we still excite the senses even more. Like, so typical a holidays, go maybe meet friends and do this and do that. And at the end of it, you don't still feel that you've felt rested. And he said it's so strange that we don't realize that what you need is to give rest to the senses themselves, not go and indulge them all the more. That's the strange thing. So here also, even in spiritual life, the same thing holds. As the Kenopanishad we saw, right? The Swami is pointing out that the we are looking in the wrong direction, as the senses would. They're pointing us outward, whereas we have to look inward. Like, that's where the divinity or true nature exists.
And when Swami was talking about that selflessness and self-interest, and when Swami was saying that it can be there to a limit, the point which was occurring to me is, the problem is, it's not its presence, but its presence in the helm of affairs.
Yeah.
If your life is being led by selfishness and self-interest, when that becomes the purpose and goal of life, I think that's when everything falls apart.
Yeah. I think the same discussion happened when during the Kenopanishad, We recalled one passage from that book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I think like it's pretty pertinent at this stage. Right, there the author very beautifully he contrasts between his son and himself, how they go mountain climbing. And the son, he has just then done maybe a 2-week course with the local YMCA on mountaineering. So he's out there to prove a point to maybe himself, to his father and everybody that I can. Right, I am good at climbing mountains. Well, his father is there. He's just there to climb the mountain and do nothing else. You know, nothing else is going on right then. So he compares, you know. So as they climb the mountain and they reach the peak, right? He compares the experience of his son and himself, right? So he notices how his son, at various points during the climb, he wants to overtake his father. So he rushes, goes ahead. And then he's trying exhausted. To catch up his breath. Yeah, he's very exhausted, fatigued. And again, he can't show to his father, right, that I am exhausted. And when he reaches right at the top, he's so irritable. And he's not able to appreciate that beautiful scenery that is now spread out, in front of him. All he can think is that, I have not done my best, or thoughts like that occupying him. Whereas he compares it to him. The father, the way he has climbed, he is, been able to observe the chirpings, the beautiful chirpings of birds, maybe even the silence, right, the deep silence that existed. And of course, come to the top completely satisfied.
Right.
So that, I think, you can see there, on the one hand, yes, that's probably prompted the son to actually come climbing with his dad. But I think the next level would be where his dad is.
Right.
So I think we can look at it.
Isn't that why we always carry a camera?
Yeah.
Most of the time we don't live the moment while it's in front of us.
Yeah.
We come back and I remember one of our colleagues was saying that they went for trekking in, Ladakh or Manali or one of these places.
Yeah.
He said, if you're not used to that, it's so very difficult,
to
be in the snow. I think they set up camp on a snowy slope and they stayed there and all that.
Mm.
He said, thank God we took pictures.
Yeah.
Because only now we are realizing how beautiful it was, because there you're so breathless because of the thin air and all of that. He said, you really enjoy the moment only after you come back and look at those pictures. I think it's a sad thing, right?
But I recall, there was a time when I used to take a camera to Kulwanthal to take, photos for during various, the amount of, the number of events you miss because you're behind the lens. It's like sometimes heartbreaking, you're there but not there.
I think that's where the what's driving you, I remember speaking to one of the old professors who in the initial years used to do a lot of photography. He said a lot of times he was lost in meditation when he was videographing. Because without your knowledge, you're focusing on Swami all the time. If not for that camera, probably you'll be sitting here and taking in the entire ambience. But standing there and sometimes being the only cameraman in the hall, you kind of feel responsible. He said, many times I've lost myself in that intense focusing on Swami. So that's what it is. As long as your direction is in the right way, I think what is a distraction would also end up being a form of aiding the whole process. So we left that story midway where Pipilada says that stay here in the ashram. So we'll go into the rest of the discourse and let's see what Swami has to say about the remaining part of that story.
Some time elapsed. After a year had gone by,
Tattva Maharshi, Maharshi yokka manumadainatundi Kumbhidi, aneetundi shishyudu vachi, Swami, ఇంత కాలం నేను ఆశ్రమంలో జీవిస్తూ వచ్చాను కానీ నా సంకల్పం అనేటువంటిది దినదినములకు అధికమవుతుండాలి.
కత్వ మహర్షిస్ గ్రాండ్ సన్ బై నేమ్డ్ కుంపిడి కేమ్ టు పిపిలాద అండ్ సెడ్, స్వామి, I have been living in this ashram for so long, but my thoughts are increasing with every passing day.
ఈ సందేహమును నాకు తీర్చి నాకు మనశ్శాంతిని చేకూర్చమని ప్రార్థించాడు.
Please clear this doubt of mine and confer on me peace of mind. He thus prayed.
ఈ సృష్టికి మూల కారకుడు ఎవరు?
Who is the cause for this creation? Who has created all these creatures? When questioned thus, Pipilada smiled and said, "Son, this is the creation of Prajapati." Hearing this, Kumpidi was heartbroken. Is this the answer I deserve after serving so long? You are saying that the one who created everyone is Prajapati. Who is this Prajapati? Food is Prajapati, he replied. It is because of food that humanity is prospering, he said. What is the source of food? Varuna or rain. Because of Varuna, the crops grow. Because of crops, the food is available to us. Son, first and foremost, our behavior is of prime importance. As is the fire, so is the smoke. As is the smoke, so is the cloud. As is the cloud, so is the rain. As is the rain, so is the crop. As is the crop, so is the food. As is the food, so is our life. So for human life, food is the very basis. Therefore, it is because of food that humanity is proliferating in this world. But this too has a basis. What is the basis for this? When questioned thus,
Suryudu Pranudu.
Sun represents life form.
Chandrudu Rami. Anaga Jadamu.
Moon represents inert.
Ee Jada Chaitanyam yokka Sammita Swarupame ee yokka srishtiki moola karanam.
This union of matter and consciousness forms the basis for creation.
Jagattunandu Jada Chaitanyamulu rendu kudanu sahajangane udbhavistayi.
Inert and consciousness occur naturally in the world.
Pranamu prani kudanu sahajangane udbhavistayi.
Life and life forms occur naturally too. The conglomeration of these two is the cause for creation. The sun's rays spread across different directions radiantly. These rays enter into the Jataragni or the digestive fire too. Entering the Jataragni, through that they become the source for creation. Be it for the inert dust in this world, be it for the woody trees, be it for the rocky mountains or for the blood-filled body, sun rays are most necessary. The life force is latent in it. The whole world is created by this life principle. It also protects the world that it creates. So he said, sun is the basis for generation, sustenance and dissolution. Answering in this manner, sun, the students of these days,
తమ యొక్క శక్తి సామర్థ్యములు గుర్తించక,
నాట్ రికగ్నైజింగ్ దేర్ స్ట్రెంగ్స్ అండ్ టాలెంట్స్,
మనోభీష్టమును నెరవేర్చుకున్నట్టుకై అనేక ప్రయత్నములు చేస్తుంటారు.
మేక్ న్యూమరస్ ఎఫర్ట్స్ టు ఫుల్ఫిల్ దేర్ డిజైర్స్,
కనుకనే విఫలుడై,
దెన్ వెన్ దే ఫెయిల్,
కేవలము ఆ నిరాశకు గురి అయి నిస్పృహ చేత,
సకమింగ్ టు హోప్లెస్నెస్ వెన్ దే బికమ్ డిప్రెస్డ్,
అలజడలను అభివృద్ధి గావిస్తుంటున్నారు,
అండ్ గ్రో రెస్లెస్,
కానీ తన యొక్క కెపాసిటీ, తన యొక్క శక్తిని తాను గుర్తించుకోవడానికి ప్రయత్నించడం లేదు.
But they are not making efforts to realize their capacity and abilities.
కరుకనే ప్రతి మానవుడు కూడాను మంచి చెడ్డలకు తన యొక్క తత్వాన్ని తాను చక్కగా గుర్తించడానికి ప్రయత్నించాలి.
Therefore, every person to know good and bad must make efforts to realize their innate nature.
ఈనాటి మానవులకు తమ జీవితంలో జీవితం యొక్క పరమావధి ఏమిటి అనేటువంటి యొక్క విషయాన్ని ఎవ్వరు కూడా తెలుసుకోవటం లేదు.
Amongst men today, there is none who is trying to know what is the purpose of their lives. They are not even worried about their ignorance of the goal of life. In one in a hundred or one in a crore, this inquiry begins. This is the primary step towards the goal of life and the ultimate.
So that was the third clip from that discourse, where Swami was talking about the continuation of that story, and Swami says that one of the disciples comes and asks almost in a sense of frustration that I've waited for 1 year. Mm. And he asks the question that
basically this is the first of the right. Six questions, right?
Who is responsible for the universe?
In other words, like from where do beings come, do beings arise? So that was the first question that the student puts.
Right.
And again, interestingly, like actually we are talking about the whole question is about how to realize the the Brahman, right? Mm-hmm. which is totally non-physical, it's the basis of the world without actually being in the world, right?
Right.
So, but the first question that arises is this, like from where do these beings come from?
Mm-hmm.
So again, like the basis is from the physical world. So from what the student perceives around him, and he's actually beginning to puzzle from that, like where do these arise from, right? So,
right.
So his question arises from the physical world about something that is beyond the physical.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe it's an attempt to, as we... I think as the other questions will suggest, to understand the nature of the universe.
Yes.
So you kind of go to the source and see where does the universe have its source, and it is likely to have the same nature of its source.
Mm.
So that's the question which is asked, and a very, what is considered as an indifferent answer comes.
Mm.
Because Swami says that the student is quite upset with the answer.
Mm.
Because he says Prajapati is the source of the entire universe.
Yeah. In fact, in the Prashnopanishad, Swami goes even further. Swami says that the Hiranyagarbham, he says that is the basis, right, of all creation.
Right.
And he says Prajapati is the manifestation of that. And then Prajapati, so essentially he says there is the Hiranyagarbha itself is no different from Brahman. And Prajapati has arisen from that, right, from the Hiranyagarbha. It's a manifestation. So he says Prajapati is basically the Brahman, the Supreme Brahman itself.
Right.
And from that has arisen. So if you look at the Prashnopanishad, the, essays or commentary on that, over here they actually say that Prajapati, he creates matter and energy, Rayi and Prana. Right, so Rai is matter and Prana is the energy which we were talking about in the Keno Upanishad. Right? So he says that Prajapati basically created these two, and by their interactions grew this entire you know, this universe, which is actually very, you know, in one sense, if you look back at the times and the place, like where such thoughts were conceived, it is really fantastic. I mean, like just a few days ago, I was reading this book, The Elegant Universe, by Brian Greene, and it's pretty interesting as he talks about, you know, how the present theories about how the universe arose. And to just think that for a significant amount of time at the beginning of the universe, basically there were nothing called particles. The particles that make up the, you know, they arose perhaps 10 seconds, right, after the initial, the birth of the universe, so to speak. It is just energy. And that at the initial stages, like, there is so much energy that it has to, the radiation has to cool down in order to create particles.
Condense to form particles.
Yeah, to condense to form particles. It's so that interplay between matter and energy, it's astounding to, you know, like right now we're able to analyze it with a host of instruments and a lot of theories, electromagnetic and quantum theories. So much is backing up this science. But that intuition, which led them to, you know, fathom this exact interaction between matter and energy. That is something really astounding. Right. Yeah.
That's what we mean, go right to the idea behind the whole thing.
Yeah.
Saying that, you know, before matter, how did the matter come to place?
Yes.
You know, what sustains the matter?
Precisely.
You know, that question, you see the universe, but there seems to be, you know, such clockwork precision in the whole thing. So something must be manning the whole thing from behind.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's the beauty of the Upanishads itself, right? You know, always that question is so profound that the question itself reveals enormous amount of thinking. So when Swami says that, the Guru says, you wait here for 1 year, you know, you withdraw your senses.
Yes.
Which means you don't, you've literally stopped measuring the world and you stopped defining the world around you using your senses. It's almost like you cut off yourself from mainly the emotions, as something which Swami would tell in an earlier discourse also. One of the first phenomenal understandings the rishis came to is that which interferes with whatever reading you do of the universe is your mind. When we do experiments in physics, you talk about you know, the temperature, you know, being an interference to your readings. The wind being an interference to your readings, or sometimes even when you're talking about studying space and light from space, you talk about the gravitational force of the atmosphere being an interference to your readings. But Swami says that first thing the rishis realized was it's the mind which is being, you know, is not letting you see the truth as it is. So reach a state of either stillness of the mind, or some would say a state of amanaska. So that is when I think these kind of deep questions start arising, and that's why the importance of Yama, Niyama, as you were saying, and Pratyahara, totally withdrawing your senses from interaction with the world.
Yeah.
It comes from that kind of a, you know, deep contemplation.
Yeah.
This question.
A couple of weeks back, I was reading this article about a kind of fad, you could call it, that's picking up in recent times. People are seeking more and more these what are called as flotation tanks.
Okay.
So, the concept is pretty interesting. So, the flotation tank is essentially designed in such a way to basically block out all the senses, right? So, first of all, it's a tank which is filled with Epsom salt, right? So, what happens, you're floating in that water. So, it's like the Dead Sea.
Right.
So, it's so dense that you're going to float on that. And then it's covered, right? And so that all light is blocked out. Then it is soundproof, so practically all the sound, and plus they put buds in your ears. So, in that way, they're practically cutting out all the senses, right? And you maybe float for an hour or so, right? And this writer was describing the kind of, you know, the spaces through which the mind goes. So, at first there's a lot of panic, right? And then a lot of wild thoughts, they start coming, very akin to meditation, right? So, and then slowly, you know, it slows you, I mean, the whole thing slows down to such an extent, time slows down, your thoughts slow down, and she was saying at that moment you begin to see everything with a lot of clarity. right? The all those issues like which you thought were plaguing you,
mm-hmm.
and all that, you suddenly see a lot of clarity, and that it's pretty close to, you know, the very intense meditation techniques like mm-hmm. vipassana, etc. So you actually get the time to look at yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, the senses are leading you here, there, and it's a wild, you know, chase. But if you can wipe them all out for a short while, you know, mm-hmm. even tame them to this extent, it's the amount of insights you get, right? You come out as a totally different person. In fact, they say it is proving very effective even in treating people with psychiatric disorders.
Okay.
Like soldiers with, you know, post-traumatic mm-hmm. stress disorder. So they, you know, they come out very relaxed. In fact, they say that, you know, in that flotation tank, you're not even aware how stiffly you hold your own body.
Okay.
Right? Even if you're told to relax, right, it's nothing compared to the relaxation you feel like there in that tank. It seems you totally let go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so mm-hmm. whereas reading that, I was just seeing, you know, the amount of wisdom that is contained in
right.
this
whole, you know, process which yeah. we are told to take up.
Yes, and I'm really telling you, Prem, that it is very difficult to fathom in the first place how these insights came up. We are talking about a time really when, as we say, right, the humankind at that time was pretty much at the mercy of nature.
Right.
And it was mostly about survival, right? Your life was all about survival. And at that time for a group of people to actually, you know, rise above all this
mm-hmm.
and then perceive something like so deep, that is that's really astonishing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, amazing. And even this idea, which is, you know, speaks about Prajapati, and mm-hmm. the next level which the explanation goes is
mm-hmm.
you know, he's the basis of food.
Yeah.
And how it's almost like food is the next thing which comes mm-hmm. From this Prajapati. And I think when you talk about food, you're not talking about, you know, the food on your plate. It's yeah. anything which forms you, anything which is
yeah.
made of.
Right.
For instance, our Venkatraman always keeps quoting that how if we really look at what we are made of, it's not any different from the dust particle which came out of the Big Bang.
Yes.
I think it's that food formation. When you talk about food, it's about that energy becoming
exactly.
matter.
Because
that's the same matter which keeps circulating.
So what's in the stars is also in us.
Right, it's in us. So yeah. when here he's saying that Prajapati gives
yeah.
food,
yeah.
and it's almost akin to that, and saying that food is so pure, because Swami goes on to say how, you know, the purity of the food defines your thoughts.
Yes.
And wonder where we lost it. And the purity, and even this, I think Swami tells very beautifully about yajnas. During one of the Dashara yajnas, Swami speaks about the importance of doing rituals such as these. Swami says very beautifully, he says that one thing which he says is the food has different components, the subtle, the subtler,
gross.
And the subtle, the subtlest. Sorry, the gross, subtle and subtlest. Where he says the subtlest forms your thoughts.
Yes.
The gross is literally excreted out.
Yeah.
The subtle becomes your your nutrients which forms your muscles and all that. The subtlest forms your thoughts.
Yeah.
Then Swami says, where does this come from? One thing is, of course, that the thoughts of the cook and the thoughts of the person who is serving the food and all of that. But the food itself contains some of those subtle emotions. And that comes from, Swami says, the rain which has fed that food.
Uh-huh.
And he says, when you do yajnas like this, especially when you're constantly thinking of the welfare of the whole world, that becomes the subtle component of the cloud which is formed. And that becomes a subtle component of the rain which comes. And that eventually becomes a subtle component of the food.
Right. These are totally like hidden from our view.
Right.
And it is absolutely so difficult beyond our perception. No?
Right.
Like it's at a level which we cannot comprehend.
Right. I think many ways when Swami used to tell one Chinnakatha, this is very pure, a sage who goes, eats in the house of somebody who offers him a meal, and then he suddenly has this desire to steal the silver glass in which he is being served.
Yes.
So I think he also steals. He comes back and he thinks why it has happened, and he realizes that I think something was cooked from a vegetable which is stolen.
Which was purchased out of stolen money or something.
I don't know. Whenever I used to hear that story, I would think, see, it again comes to that, you will not sense this relationship between thoughts and something as gross as food if you're not in that level of purity.
Yeah.
Why is it that it never occurs to us? Probably it's so many emotions and tendencies in our mind, you don't sense a change in your thinking when something like that happens.
Yeah, and at that precise moment when you're feeling like totally helpless and hopeless that you simply cannot avoid it, and Swami gives us the antidote. He says, don't worry, whenever you eat, you chant the Brahmarpanam.
Right.
Because that way, as with anything, no, Swami says, you offer anything to God and then like you're all right. Ditto with food too. You offer it and Swami says that even in this discourse he's bringing up that the sun is being, even in the Prashna Upanishad, the sun is being spoken about as a very powerful principle, right? So they speak about basically the sun giving rise. First of all, sun takes the place of prana in the Prashna Upanishad.
Right.
Sun takes the place of prana. And they compare matter, the rai, to the moon.
To moon, right.
Which is like the reflected light, right? So this, just as the moon is shining out of the reflected light of the sun, they say the rays of the sun, which stand for prana, they come and animate, the different, the beings in all quarters of the earth. It's a very beautiful, very poetic piece to read in that. But essentially, metaphorically speaking about how, no, prana is the life-giving principle,
right,
and which due to which all these beings suddenly spring to life, right, and again, how this Swami says how this same principle is present within the human body as this Jataragni, right, which which then accepts the food, and that's why Swami says that if when you chant the Brahmarpanam and you are aware of this principle of God being present inside you, that immediately purifies any anything that you intake. Right?
So right. And many times when I look at it, you know, something as simple as this, Swami says, just do Brahmarpanam and just be conscious of what you're saying. And that Aham Vaishvanaro Bhutva. It occurs to me like, you know, the relationship between science and technology. If you're really a scientific person, you know, have that scientific temperament, you can go into science, go into, you know, fundamental research of science. But technology is for everybody. The technology is based on that scientific research which people have done. But the technology, you don't need to be a scientist to use technology. You know, you don't need to know what are the scientific breakthroughs which have brought the mobile phone to you.
Yeah.
But you can use it.
You can.
So many times you, I mean, now when you look at this entire study of how they start with energy and how that becomes matter and how that becomes food and how, you know, the purity and impurity affects you. And then you say, okay, chad brahmarpanam. It's almost like Swami's cut out that entire thing.
Given the technology.
You're too kiddish for that. You're too immature to understand all of that.
Yeah.
So this is the technology which you can use. Just chant Brahmarpanam before you do.
Yes.
And even when Swami says things like see good, do good, help ever, hurt never, the way Swami started this, paropakaram, it's like the essence of all that. Someone has sat in the lab and done the research. You know, the patents
the
have been filed. And, you know, it's reached your doorstep as technology. Use it as it is.
Yeah.
Probably one day if you have the interest, you can go to the science lab, but you don't have to wait till then to use the technology.
Yeah.
Right. And then Swami says this, that part in Telugu was very, very beautiful. Where Swami says, whether it's a rocky mountain, a woody tree, a bloody body, or, you know, whatever be the nature of the matter, it comes from the same source.
Right.
Swami tells that very beautifully in that. And then, again, just what we were talking about. He says, the sage's reply to these students that as long as you're struggling only to satisfy fleeting desires, your mind will never turn towards these and, you know, recognize these things.
Right, No, it's not just like, you know, again, I was going back to, my mind is going back to what we were discussing right at the beginning. But some points that you mentioned in between also, like how the mind distorts reality.
Right.
And basically, all of us, the way we lead our lives is like we are trying to I don't know, silence our mind that keeps saying, you know, things like, you need to be admired more, you need to be respected more, you need more money, you need more fame. And if we look at it, our entire lives are led in feeding these conversations. Right? Either you're trying to silence them or you're going to, you know, but it's much the same as, you know, how our, if our gross senses are leading us astray in that sense, even the, you know, these thoughts, the subtle thoughts also, which are like brain patterns, right? Which, and keep leading us, like, which keeps us from actually expressing who we truly are. Even if you look at, you know, students today, right? If much of what, let's just look at students in, say, the age group of who are attending that summer course. And always when I look at students, I just feel, what if they could get everything together, right? What if they all had it together, right? And all the talents, all the skills that they had, now that could be channelized so beautifully, right? But with most students, that's what happens, right? They look at their peers, then they start comparing themselves, and a lot of inadequacies, all those conversations start, you know? And that's how we are not able to totally express who we are, because we're totally caught up in working on those aspects.
And we see that, you know, even as simple as, let's say I'm sitting and listening to a discourse, the way the mind works is you're literally trying to pick out aspects of that discourse, which not you have to follow necessarily, but which are already suitable for your life, right? And many times, you know, our idea of spirituality or of understanding itself is clouded by that desire to justify what we're already doing. You know, that's why, you know, that the desire to be accepted in the society, the desire even to your own self.
Yes.
You know, not to be pleasant to the people in the room, but even to your own self, to have that justify that self dignity and say that I'm doing the right thing. How much that how much we lose, you know, in that kind of a thinking, in absorbing, how much you lose. So when they say that brahmacharya, the aspect of truth, the aspect of ahimsa, I think all of those four or five qualities which Swami would say, which come under niyama and satya, niyama and yama.
Yes.
Under yama, I think it's ahimsa, satya,
aparigraha,
asteya, aparigraha, and brahmacharya. And I think in niyama, it is again purity and some of the other things. Sama, dhamma, I think that comes under this one. I mean, all of these things of you purifying your, you know, nature, your existence in every day. How much are you able to cut it out from the gallery and do things as you're supposed to do? And how that is so important in this entire journey. And that's why Swami says in this part which we just played, that it happens for 1 in 100, 1 in 1 crore. And if you're in that place, I think you go and ask this Derek question.
It's a terrifying statistic.
Right. But you never know. You never know whether you're in the one or you're in the rest of the crowd.
Yeah. In fact, there is a Upanishad called the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. And in that, there's a sentence like you can read it and feel happy or you can feel devastated. But it says that ultimately Brahman is revealed to the person whom Brahman chooses. So, like, and I recall what Swami has also said in another place. It's very, hilarious to read it. But Swami is speaking about the different yogic paths that are available to us. And finally he says, do you know who decides, like, which path of yoga you take? It is I who decides. So it all comes down to us really praying to Bhagwan. Right, that's why Swami says prayer is that important. The Gayatri Mantra, any of our prayers, the Yoyona Prachodayat, give me that, we pray for that intellect that illumines, you know. So,
somebody was saying life is a dream, and let's say you're sleeping and you're dreaming, nothing that you do in your dream can wake you up. You said somebody who's awake has to come and wake you up.
True.
Probably you can just, you know, if you're becoming a nuisance by talking too much in your dream, the person outside will wake you up. But of course, I mean, it's very easy for us to say things like that, but dear listeners, definitely we are not in a level where we can completely understand these things. That's why it's easier to just completely listen to Swami and do what Swami tells us to do. And I think all of this, even the study of Swami's discourses or whatever we do participatively in obedience to Swami is just that.
Hmm.
Best bet is you catch somebody, you want to cross the road, catch the uncle's finger and don't let go. Somebody said, you know, the problem comes when you start telling that, no, that uncle seems to be moving faster, let's go catch his finger.
Mm-hmm.
This uncle doesn't seem to be crossing the road at all.
Yeah.
So I think Hari will conclude with that. I think we have completed our time too. So dear listeners, do join us again next week for the remaining part of the discourse. I think what we've played so far is about one-fourth of that discourse. So do join us again next week at 7:30 for this program, Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. We most humbly offer this effort of ours at Swami's Lotus Feet. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the second episode of our Radio Sai Youth Hour. We started this a couple of weeks back. So I'm sure this week too, Bishu is getting something very interesting for all of you. So do stay tuned. He'll be joining you in a very short while.